Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I talked to Sam McTrusty of Twin Atlantic. And, well, as I say this so many times, you're in for a treat. Sam's an absolutely delightful human being. We have a wonderful natter about tunes. Before we get on with that chat, a few thank yous. Thanks to Ashley for helping put this together. Big love to Scroobius Pip and everybody at the Distraction Pieces Network. Thank you to 76 for producing this. And thanks to you lot for just being nice, for pressing play on this podcast, for subscribing, for liking and sharing and, you know, doing all the retweets and stuff when you see me on the social. So just a huge thanks. It really helps. And yeah, appreciated. If this happens to be the first time you've listened to this podcast, when you get to the very end of this Ace Natter with Sam, go explore the back catalogue, because there's 350 episodes available and you can hear me talking to the likes of the Foo Fighters, Motley Crue, Travis, Suede, Idols, Sleaford Mods, James Acaster, Ed Gamble, Maxine Peake, Joe Hartley, Thomas Turgoose, Butch Vig. There's Chuck D of Public Enemy, Fatboy Slim. Go have a rummage, because there's, like I say, over 350 episodes with all your favourite musicians, actors, producers, DJs, comedians. They've all been on, and there's some delightful chats to be enjoyed. Anyway, I have a delightful chat to you enjoy, for you to enjoy right now. Please enjoy Off the Beaten Track Podcast with Sam of Twin Atlantic. Sorry, I've interrupted the podcast, but with good reason. Hotel Chocolat are our sponsors. You know that now because I tell you about it every episode. But they've been super kind now. And you may have heard me talking about the products from the cacao bar. And there's gins, cream liqueurs, all sorts of wonderful chocolatey goodies. And what they've done is they've set a page up on the website that you can go to. And all you've got to do is, just for you Off the Beaten Track listeners, go over there, answer a question, and you could win the full range delivered to your front door. I mean, that's kind of them. All you have to do is go to this place, hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. That's OTBT as in Off the Beaten Track podcast. hotelchocolat.com/OTBT podcast. Go get your grubby little mitts on some deliciously chocolatey drinks, courtesy of our sponsors, Hotel Chocolat. I'll get back to the podcast. It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin. Okay, we are recording. Sam, how are you doing today?
I'm good, mate. I'm very good. I've not had as much sleep as I would like, but that is life as a parent.
Young ones?
Yeah, just the one. I've got a 2-year-old daughter. But it's actually my own fault. I've started watching, I've now forgotten what it's called. Is it called Squid Game on Netflix?
Oh, someone was literally telling me about this yesterday, saying it's incredible.
So the first episode is so bizarre. You're kind of like, I think it depends what format you watch it in. You can watch it because it's a Korean show, I think. And you can watch it in like their native language with English subtitles, or you can watch it like dubbed with English audio. And obviously that's a bit kind of sterile and it takes you out of the story a wee bit, but I opted to not read and just listen. So the first episode took me a wee minute to get used to, but then I think I ended up watching like five episodes back to back last night. So it's my own fault.
Right.
I tried to blame it on my kids. But
I was just trying to think how in any way, shape or form is that your child's fault?
Well, because I had to get up early.
Right. Yeah. Had you gone to bed at a sensible time, it would have been fine, right?
Basically, it's my fault. But that's a nice little synopsis of my approach to life right there, is I'll make a mistake and then blame someone else.
Okay. Well, looking back over the last sort of 17, 18 months, Sam,
yep.
Obviously we're recording this at the end of September, and, you know, we're currently in, you know, what appears to be a better place than where we was this time last year. I just wondered how, you know, just looking back briefly on lockdown, like how that affected you personally and creatively.
Well, personally, I guess it was it's such a wild swinging pendulum on the spectrum of good to bad. I think that the overall thing, I kind of go with the midpoint where it was. Well, my wife Caitlin works in the hospital; she's a nurse, so it was quite a kind of immediate effect to our sort of family life because she was on maternity leave. And wasn't fully qualified yet, but kind of had a gun to the head scenario where it was like, you need to come in and work for the NHS full time now, or don't at all ever again type of thing. So we kind of had to change the whole dynamic, and I became stay at home dad rather than the guy who was obviously we haven't actually been touring that much because we were at home making a record the 2 years leading up before the pandemic. But that was still a lot of time away from home. Long hours in the studio and stuff, so we kind of flipped that whole dynamic. But then I loved it because I got to spend time with my daughter that I thought I wasn't really going to have in a consistent way. But then on the sort of creative side, that was the question, wasn't it? Personally and creatively, on the creative side, I kind of did what I've always done since I was a wee boy, which is just when something is difficult for me to process or relate to or emotionally deal with, I kind of channel it into being creative. And that's sort of why I got into music in the first place, I think. That's what it sort of means to me, rather than this sort of identity tag of like coolness or something like that. Sure. It's more of an emotional connection for me. And so I brought stuff home from our studio. And just in my spare time between looking after Sadie or on Caitlin's days off, I would then kind of go into it was actually my daughter's spare room. I ended up making an album, a full album, kind of by mistake, because I reached out to someone that I was meant to be going to America. I was meant to be going to California to write a song with someone I'd worked with before. And so at the beginning of lockdown, kind of like everyone else, I was like, this will be like a couple of months tops, but I'll reach out to this guy and see if we're still going to do it, or if we could do it remotely, because I'd heard people had started to do that in the first week or two. And then all of his stuff had been cancelled, so the two of us basically just went, that was quite good, will we do another one? And in the first 6 weeks of lockdown, I ended up with a full record. By mistake, but I love it. Sorry, that was quite a long
answer. Not at all. You answered that, because it wasn't a knee-jerk thing of like, right, I've got this time, I've got to make it can. I like it when things sort of happen like that. It's been a real kind of mixture of answers to this question when I've asked previous guests, and some people said, like, the minute I knew that I wasn't going to be touring, I was going to just throw myself head into writing a record, and it just weren't happening. Like I wanted it to because the time was there, but it just weren't happening. And you know, the fact that it was a happy accident, that's glorious, man.
Well, I do feel really, really lucky because we're you know, I'm starting to do interviews and basically talk about myself now to people. And I do, my overall overriding feeling is total, I mean, I feel a little bit guilty about it, if anything, because some bands or other artists were forced into getting kind of a more mainstream job or like a more normal job, whatever, you know, that's the easiest way to kind of call it that. And then maybe couldn't afford to keep going. But I've just been so lucky that I've been doing it for so long. I've got some toys and things like that that I could play with, and people around me that were kind of helping me to get it done. I think it was more to keep me distracted, because we had an album come out in the January of 2020, and it was this huge, huge lead into it where, I mean, like, I was producing it, did the artwork. I mean, it was like I did too much. I took on too much of a workload, and basically before it came out, I had a bit of a wobble about it all as well, and kind of wasn't really in a good place. So the timing of the pandemic was kind of good for me selfishly. I always try and find the positive out of every situation. This is obviously an extreme one, but I think the people around me and my management and stuff like that were thinking, right, how do we keep this guy creatively ticking over so that he doesn't go back to where he was a few months ago? Because I just was in the sort of trenches of, by the way, this is all super first world problems.
We're talking about you today, mate.
I know, but these aren't like real life struggles. It was just in my little bubble they were, because I've been making music and chasing the impossible dream, whatever that, I don't even know what the end goal is from being in this particular band, but I just get so swept up in it and too involved that I just lost track of why I was even doing it, I think. So the idea of then being locked back in a bedroom with very kind of minimal gear and quite a lot of obstacles. Like the guy I was working with, Jack Knife Lee, a producer, he was based in LA. So it was an 8-hour time difference plus a 1-year-old to look after at the time. So I was working, I think I started maybe at like 8-9 o'clock at night when she was kind of settled. And then I'd work to like maybe 3-4 in the morning or something like that. And then I'd get up at 7 with the kid again and do it all over again.
That's some serious plate spinning there, man.
I was actually annoyed. Everyone was learning how to like make bread and like going on, you know, doing exercise. And I was like, that looks quite good. Why am I doing this? Or going through like movie catalogues and TV shows that they wanted to watch and reading books. And I was problem solving an album that I didn't know was an album at the time. But
with Jack Knife Lee, though?
With Jack Knife Lee.
I mean, that's cool.
That's another example of, this was all self-inflicted and I'm trying to blame everybody else. Again, that's my go-to move. But yeah, with Jack Knife Lee, yeah.
What a producer he is, mate.
Man, he's more, do you know, he's become more than a producer to me. He's like a mentor or like a kind of a father figure within creative thinking. And ultimately just a good mate, because it was, if it had been anyone else that I was just kind of scheduled in to go and write with, it would never have happened. It was just, you know, I had his number, I could text him on a level to be like, do you fancy this? And I think if it had been anyone else, we wouldn't have got as much material written, because there wasn't that initial hurdle of like, oh, fuck, talking about the pandemic all the time. We kind of went straight back, because I've worked with him before. We'd done another full-length album called GLA in 2015 with him, came out in 2016, and then he'd helped us pull together some of this, the last finishing touches on another album we've got, Great Divide, and the songs we did with him all ended up being the only singles off that record. So we knew it was like an instant creative spark we had. So to have someone like that as my safety net,
yeah,
is so, so spoiled. Anyone listening who doesn't know who he is, he works with like U2, REM, The Killers, bands that fill stadiums. Do you know what I mean? So I don't know why. I don't know why he continues to want to work with us, but it must just be we've got that sort of friendship level thing happening.
And if I'm right, he was in his own band as well back in the day, wasn't he?
He was, band
Compulsion. Yeah. And for listeners of this podcast, you get a chance to listen to Malmonarchy, the single by Compulsion. Fuck me, that's a stonker of a record, that is. Go give that one a whirl. Right, well, look, we're talking records today, Sam. And for track one, I'm going to ask you, please, to tell me the song that you regard as having the greatest ever intro.
I'm glad I've got my own answers in front of me here by mistake. I'm usually not this organised.
You can have honourable mentions, because when I've asked you a question for your hometown, fuck me, you sent me over about 10. So you can have some honourable mentions, man.
Well, for the question you've asked now, I've picked U2 where the streets have no name. There is another song there, Arctic Monkeys, Brainstorm, but the U2, I mean, I think every musician or band wishes they started an album like that. It's just so cinematic and engaging. I think it's gone through a bit of a roller coaster with opinion, I'm sure, because I bet when it came out, it was like considered arrogant or like a bit self-indulgent or something like that. But over time, oh, I mean, I'm 33, so I think it came out the year I was... What year did it come out? 87?
Yes.
That's my birth year, so I don't really know what I'm talking about in terms of how it was react. That's just my take on it, but it's just... I thought it was just so engaging. It's just so like rousing and emotional, but epic, and the song delivers as well after... I mean, I've tried to do that. Do the big epic cinematic thing, and we've made it so good that then we can't compete with our intro.
We
did it kind of recently. We did it about 2 years ago, and we just had to delete it.
Yeah.
But I could have given so many more answers for this, but I tried to be pragmatic and almost practical.
It's really weird, Sam. I've done 360 of these podcasts and no one's chose that yet. And I'm really surprised, because it's an absolute masterpiece. And I'm 48. And I would have been 14, 15 when Joshua Tree dropped. And I don't remember it being met with that much criticism for it being pompous or overblown or anything like that. I think at the time they'd come, this is 2 years after Live Aid, and they'd stole the show there, and then they just put together this perfect record. I think, I think the kind, for me looking in on it, I think the kind of the pomp and the kind of people sort of starting to dig at maybe Bono more than the band a bit more kind of come a few years later, I think, with the with some of the latter albums. But for me, I think that was the last record that U2 done where the live shows weren't about lights and, kind of him phoning up Salman Rushdie and doing all of these crazy things and landing in like Big Lemons and stuff like that on stage. It was Bono, white vest, pair of jeans, walking out there. He didn't need anything else, because his voice was one of the most incredible things ever. And that intro... The build-up is beautiful, and obviously you just get the best introduction to Edge's guitar you could ever want to hear. Mm-hmm. But it's when that opening line of Bono's voice, it's just perfect, isn't it? And it just gathers speed.
Well, it makes sense now. They'd earned the right to do it, obviously, then with that performance at Live Aid. So that makes sense why they got away with it. But yeah, it's the tone. Something about the tone of his voice. It's just so satisfying when it cuts through. I agree. It's probably that moment that makes the intro.
So with that, and over the last sort of 8 months making another record and with intros, I've spent 360 podcasts trying to frame this question correctly, and I never quite manage it. But Streets Have No Name's a really good example of something that's really long, and obviously you get the payoff when it drops. But the way that music's consumed now, and the way that algorithms, you know, and all of that stuff that doesn't seem very, what's the word I'm looking for, organic and real, all of these things that unfortunately have filtered into the recording industry, I don't know if a band went into a record company now and said, oh, this is our single. It's called Where the Streets Have No Name. By the way, you won't get a vocal for over a minute. Like, I wonder if that would happen now. And so, I don't think that's a good thing, by the way. I want to throw that out there. A song should be a song.
I can give you some hope. It wasn't a single of ours, but the album I was mentioning of ours that came out in January 2020 was called Power. And the first song was called Oh Euphoria. And on the vinyl, which is kind of, that's like the full length album, because we had to cut it down for other things. The vinyl, I think the intro is like 2.5 minutes or something like that of just a drum groove. Just a groove for honestly, I need to look it up. I'm sure it's like over 2 minutes. I mean, I'm kind of answering your question for you because it wasn't a single.
but do you, are these kind of things considerations for you when you write songs now? You know, the fact that
algorithms and like how, you know, you've got 3 seconds.
Snapchat and all of that stuff that you know, the people that, you know, TikTok and the way that people are sort of consuming, young people are consuming music now. It does seem very fast paced and attention spans appear to be getting tighter. And I just wondered if that ever filters through into your creative process when you're sort of, you know, right, this is going to be a single.
Mm-hmm.
Do I want to get the chorus in? Do I want to start with the chorus? Do any of that sort of things find their way into your creative brain?
Yes, but not because of what's going on tech-wise or anything. I've always kind of thought that way because the space that we sort of have occupied, because we're a bit of an oddball band, like we're not really a radio pop band, we're not really a rock band, we're not an alternative band or an indie band. We're not even sure what type of band we are. But because of that, I've always just focused on like making sure the songs have got quality as the sort of main sort of, I don't know, stitch between all the records and the songs. And I've kind of tried to like study as best I can on my own, at least, like the greats and what they do well. And I've always been really conscious of, like, I think because I've felt like an underdog the whole time we've been doing this, especially in the very beginning, because I was just so desperate to do what we're doing now and to travel and be away from Glasgow and just be in music. I was like, you need to grab people's attention instantly. So I kind of always thought that way. And I've even looked at, like, I've always kind of, now I'm sort of in charge. I'm at the helm of the computer and recording a lot of stuff. But even back in the day, I was like, when does that chorus hit? What is that? Because I'd heard that if you can get a chorus to hit between 50 seconds and a minute, I think it's like 90% of all number one songs or something like that do that.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, why would I not fucking do that?
Yeah, of course.
Why would I not want to hit that sweet spot knowing that is there? But don't get me wrong, we've also got like 6.5 minute prog rock songs in there and like 5 minute long ambient instrumental songs and things like that in our back catalogue. Probably because I've overanalyzed pop structure. A way that we got around recently, like the first single we've got off our new album, in the intro, it's just a kind of like, it's a guitar and drum groove, and it basically is just going round and round. But I got my mum to like talk over it because that was the way of keep catching people's attention and keeping them in the song. But yeah, people say that to people. People do go on about it and say, oh, that won't do well at streaming because it's too whatever in the first 30 seconds.
Which, but you can't be governed by that, can you? It's like,
I promise you that I'm not. I do take it in and I'm listening, but I don't think I'm too into the emotional development of a song to give up that part of it. Because like I was saying in the beginning, that's why I do what I try to do. It's quite. If you allow yourself to really focus on it, it's quite depressing that that's the
100%. 100%. Well, you mentioned emotion. So for track two, Sam, I'm going to ask you to tell me, please, the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
Yes, sir. Bruce Springsteen's Thunder Road.
Okay.
I only used to see my dad at the weekends, like on a Sunday. And we would go like really long drives into the sort of beginning of the Scottish Highlands, sort of like Loch Lomond area, and a wee bit further north than that, you get into Glencoe, which, if you're not familiar with it, is like basically a road right up the middle of all these epic mountains, and they're quite ugly and like really. Like rock based. There's not many plants or anything like that. It's like a bit of a barren wasteland to drive through. But my dad would always. This was like mixtape era, because I'm sure my earliest memory of this is probably somewhere around like 7 or 8 or something like that. And there would be loads of songs. I'm trying to think what the other songs would be. It was in that. Sort of ballpark of Bruce Springsteen and the American sort of song book writers like Neil Young, but then we'd also listen to like full Whitney Houston records and things like that. But this song always stood out. Maybe it was where it was on the mixtape or something like that he had. I'm not sure why, or maybe it was the surroundings. And I've gone to like study Springsteen pretty in depth, but he was always going on about escapism and cinematic writing. And it just maybe matched what we were doing on these long drives, and I remember that's the first sort of moment in a song where I was like taking something away from it more than like, oh, this is fun, or that sounds cool, or that's funny, or like exciting or something. It was like it made me feel hopeful or sad. Even as a kid, I remember having that sort of getting it. I don't know. I mean, it's quite a kind of grown-up song to get at that age, but I was probably just quite lucky with the surroundings.
What do you think the emotion was, Sam? If you had to pinpoint it,
I'm not sure if that. I mean, it's that. I mean, the sweet spot between happiness and sadness is probably like. I don't know, it's like a mixture of hope and nostalgia, like being excited about the future, but also kind of sad about the past or the present. I'm not sure what that emotion is, but that song, it's the chord progression of the song and the vocal melody. When you mix them together, it just sounds like desperation, but like getting out of it. Do you know what I mean? It's like climbing out or... I'm not sure if I'm skewed now with like my adult brain and my songwriting experience reviewing this now, I've got the lyrics tattooed on my wrist, so I do mean what I'm saying. But I just remember that song just almost like, I don't know, it was like when my soul was ignited or something like that with music, and like then music meaning something else to me. That's where the addiction began, was hearing that song. I'm not really answered you, have I? I don't know what the emotion is.
I think you nailed that when you said like the sweet spot between happiness and sort of sadness. I think that's a really nice way to kind of try and fathom where your mind was at such a young age, and hearing something that's...
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Biked it, and like you say, set your soul on fire. It's like, I think, you know, at such a young age, generally songs just kind of wash over you, don't they? And I think every now and again, if something does spike like that, then it really does spike.
Well, I mean, the song before it was maybe like, I don't know, Whitney Houston, I Want to Dance with Somebody. Yeah. And then the song after it was maybe like Deacon Blue or something like that. Nothing wrong with either. I mean, they're probably in my top 100 favorite songs or something. But there was something about this song that just, it was just different. It just sounded more, I don't know. I still don't know. Maybe that's a good thing.
That's the magic, mate. Stand in the formative years for track three. I'm going to ask you to tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Yeah, well, it was an easy one to pick, Blink-182, because I think from like second year right through till what you know, when I was at college and uni, all I listened to was Blink-182. That is literally all I listened to. Probably in quite an obsessive, creepy way, but the song is Anthem Part 2. It's the opening track from an album of theirs, Take Off Your Pants and Jacket. And I was in second year at high school, and I'd kind of just started getting into like guitar music. I've got an older sister, Alana. She's 2 years older than me, and she was already there. She was listening to like kind of more like skater punk, kind of somewhere between ska and like pop punk music she was into, which I didn't think I wasn't that into, but I liked that kind of triggered me listening to like guitar bands. And then a mate of mine at school, what he used to go into HMV and get CD singles and take the sticker off the CD singles and put them on the albums, take them up to the cash desk and only have to pay like £2 or £3.
Wait.
Instead of like 21, whatever. That record was probably about £22 back in the day. So I got a loan of this album from him for like 2 weeks. And the opening track in that is like really direct, like a syncopated guitar drum sort of interplay riffing. And I remember just being like, oh my fucking God, what is that?
Yeah.
Like people, I've heard people talk about hearing Nirvana for the first time and they had that moment with rock music. That song was my like slow motion brain exploding in a mushroom cloud thing where I was like, holy fuck.
am I right in saying that fast forward X amount of years, did you play with support Blink?
Yeah, we did, mate. It still doesn't feel real to me. And even when I replay the memories from it, I'm like, that just is so surreal and bizarre.
Yeah.
We actually toured with them twice. They had us on two separate UK tours. They did a comeback sort of tour after they split up the first time for a few years. And that was like really, really hyped up for obvious reasons because they've got such a cult following that like because we were the support band, we instantly, everyone that liked their band liked our band, just as a like matter of, it used to be like, oh, who's the Blink support band? And then you would go and listen to them for like the 3 months leading up to the tour. So that was a huge, huge leg up for us. But then I'm cutting about backstage with them and they're talking to me and going into like Travis Barker's dressing room. I just couldn't keep my cool. I just couldn't. I was just so, so freaked out and nervous and in awe of them that I just wasn't being myself. They were being totally normal and being like, oh, what are you guys up to? And, oh, you're working with this producer. We've met him and blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, hey, thanks for having us on the tour. Like, just couldn't be myself around them.
Why do you think that was? Like, you've earned your stripes. You know, you've... You know, your band's done what you've done. You're there rightly. Excuse me. Do you ever suffer with, like, imposter syndrome?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, like, even just now doing this podcast with you, in the back, there's the voice in the back of my head is like, no one cares, mate. Why are you talking about yourself? Nobody cares. I'm being truthful there. There's been a couple of moments where I was like, right, that is a long answer, Sam. Fucking hell, no one is that into what you're saying. I think, I don't know, it's maybe just like I'm not like a really good musician or anything like that. It's not really why I write songs. I don't really care about getting good at guitar or getting really good at singing. Sometimes I get that imposter syndrome feeling because I'm like, at any second I could be found out that I don't have a clue what I'm doing.
Yeah, but the proof's in the records, man. It doesn't matter
it's hard to argue with that, I know, because I sound like I'm being overly humble or something to seem like a nice guy, but I genuinely do feel like every day I'm like, how am I going to prove it to people that I'm really good at pulling it all together, I mean, and making a song. But I think I know why I was like that with Blink in particular, because we've toured with loads of other like mega rock stars and I've been in the same, you know, I've met Dave Grohl and chatted away to him about stuff and I wasn't as overawed as I was with them, but I feel like when I started high school in 99, 2000, in second year, 2000, 2001, was like the explosion of like Californian culture on sort of the UK and Europe. And the pop punk thing just was like spoon fed to me by radio. But then all the other culture that was going on around me at the time was like American Pie movies were coming out. Jackass was on TV, like reruns all night, every night. Like Tony Hawk skateboarder for the PlayStation, skateboarding was like the biggest game. Do you know what I mean? That was like my generation's Grand Theft Auto or whatever. Yeah. And so to be in the presence of these guys that were like the talisman for that whole cultural movement, it was bigger than because the music wasn't super groundbreaking. It was like power chords and like some of the songs were like just about dick jokes and like being at high school, and it was just a timing thing, but these guys were like the epicenter of that to me, so I felt like I was in the presence of something really important.
I think, yeah, some of their songs were, you know, about dick jokes and were, you know, straight up punk chords. Nirvana have got these songs that are just straight up punk chords. It's not Radiohead by any means, but Blink and Nirvana, their pop sensibilities are off the fucking scale. They know how to make people react and respond and pull them in. Never mind the greatest pop record ever made, in my opinion. Like, every song on that record is so catchy. It's full of hooks, full of like amazing choruses, and Blink literally followed that blueprint, and I think Blink done exactly the same, just catchy as fuck pop songs, but with just like noisy guitars, and it's like, that's what a lot of teenagers need.
Well, I'll probably get stick for this, but it's just what I think. that the self-titled Blink record, the one that's the smiley face on the front with the paint dripping down, that to me is as good an album as Nevermind. And I know it's probably not as important. No, I know it's not as important culturally, and it didn't have, rightly so, the same impact on music. I'm maybe a bigger Nirvana fan now, by the way, than a Blink fan, because I then worked my way back.
Yeah.
But to me, it's like as perfectly crafted. It's the sweet spot between just out and out pop perfection meeting like artistic freedom of speech and license. And like some of the stuff they did on that record, like, I'm not like a super, if anything, I'm like anti-war, anti-army person, but there's a speech written and read out on that Blink record by like, a widower whose husband went off to fight in Afghanistan, and she's reading out a letter to him if he'd still, do you know what I mean? There's things on it that are really like creatively inspiring, risk-taking things that Nirvana were doing obviously on Nevermind, but three-piece power pop rock records, to me, they're like on a par.
Yeah. Okay. Track four. First song you remember buying from a record shop.
Yeah. Well, with my own money, that was my decision. Because really, the true answer to this is my dad took me and my sister into a record store and went, you can get any CD you want. And this, we never did that again. After it was some, he must have had a rush of blood to his head or something. And I picked Jimmy Nail's first album.
Nice.
I know that's not my answer here, but that wasn't my. That was a panic thing.
Yeah.
That I just looked at all. It was. So, I mean, I don't know what I was doing, but the first thing I went in, I remember going into town. I'm going to get this CD. Well, I got it on tape. Was Craig David's Rewind. It's featuring someone, it's featuring Craig David, it's by someone else. I can't remember it's like a UK garage DJ.
Artful Dodger.
Artful Dodger, thank you. So it's Artful Dodger featuring Craig David, right?
Mm.
I don't know what I was doing. I don't know if I was trying to impress a girl or something like that I knew all the words or something. I don't know. I remember buying it, and me and a mate went back to like a girl's house where there was other girls from our year at school, and I just was like so terrified of girls. They were just like so powerful and like much smarter than me and like in control of the situation at all times compared to my like nervous little, like, probably horny little brain at the time. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, yeah, we went into town, went to HMV, and we bought these, and like, I bought this, and like, remember putting the tape in and playing it. And I was all like, there's probably like six or seven of us all sitting around in this girl's room, like, listening to it. Ah, fucking hell.
It's great though, right? I mean, their memories. I mean, you can vividly remember that, which is, I mean, that's what music's about, right?
I remember taking the tape out of the, because it was in like a sort of cardboard sleeve. The sleeve was like black and green. And I remember being like, oh shit, they're saying, what did you buy? And like, now it's my time to put this on. We just listened to what the record, the CDs or whatever the singles they bought that day. And like sat around in a group listening to them. I remember being nervous, like, oh fuck, why did I buy this? I don't even know if I like this. I should have bought like What's My Age Again, Blink-182 or something like that. What did I do this for? I think I was just trying to be like cool at the time, because that was like that was before it was like a big, I think it was like the day it came out, so it wouldn't have been number one yet or something like that. Yeah,
I mean, it's a big record, wasn't it? And like, you know, Craig David was a, I mean, that was a song I guess that launched him really, and he became a megastar, didn't he? And
megastar did, yeah.
And has had a huge resurgence in recent times as well. I mean, the first record, this is the question where it's perfectly fine to have something that ain't that cool. That's what this question was designed for. That
I think it's probably cooler to have shit answers,
100%.
Like, you know, or Craig David Rewind. It's not even a good record, but it's I mean, it's got like comedy fucking spring sound effects in it, yeah, and stuff like that, doesn't
it? It's got glass smashing as well.
Aye, stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's like the Ross from Friends song when he has the
big explosion at the end.
Yeah. But like that was when like UK Garage was like absolute peak. Five of the songs in the top 10 were all by different, do you know what I mean? So I just kind of, I do get swept up in like popular culture in general. So I'm not surprised that I did that. Now I think about it, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That's what I got at the time.
For track 5, I'm going to ask you please to tell me the song that soundtracked your year's clubbing, please.
Well, I don't know how big of a clubbing person I was, but...
This can also be, Sam, this can also be going to your local indie night or anything like that. It hasn't necessarily got to be...
I did, but my next part of that was I did go to loads and loads of club nights because that's just what you do in Glasgow. There's a culture here to... I know that's not unique, but it's just particularly set up that way in Glasgow because there's, like, a history of, like... I guess like almost like snobbery of club music here, and like the club night experience is taken really seriously here. But yeah, anyway, the song is by Felix the House Cat. It's called Ready to Wear. Do you know that? Do you know that song? Do you know something? There's like a thread through all the stuff that I'm saying here, but it's got that sort of sweet spot between happiness and sadness, nostalgia, hopefulness. It just had the same effect on me as like the Springsteen song or the U2 intro. It's I still listen to it. I probably listen to that like a handful of times every month just to like retune harmonically what is going on in that song. I want to do that. I still haven't figured it out. But that's the song that like we would all take really, really serious. Like it was more like when you would go back to somebody's house or flat after a night out, that's what we would play. So it's, I feel like I've got more memories of listening to that at an after party thing than I do.
Sure.
It's a bit of a come down song, just like the atmosphere of it. Oh man, it's perfect. I hope people listen to it. Or have people who have heard it or been reminded of it, because it's quite an old song now.
You touched on, you know, when you were talking about buying the Craig David single, about, you know, being sort of terrified of girls at that age. And I want to ask you two questions here, Sam. And I want to know, you know, in these formative years, was you confident? Well, I'll let you answer that first, and then I'll follow it up. And if you wasn't, where do, you know, is that something you could learn to be more confident?
I think so. I think I was doing this sort of like growing up. Before like adolescence or whatever, even at school, I was always performing, but not in a way that you would think, oh, that guy's going to get into like acting or music or something like that. I was more just like a class clown sort of, like a Robin Williams character that like I can't help but turn something into a joke or be a show off or like...
You like the attention?
I think so. Aye, probably an attention seeker rather than like... meriting the attention by doing something good or talented or whatever. But I think then when I went to high school, I went to a different school than all my friends before. And I think I just had to like be confident. Do you know what I mean? Just had to like, I'm not really answering your question. I think, yeah, you can learn how to be more confident, but it's probably something that's always been there. I don't know. Really good question. That might be the best question I've ever been asked. in an interview, I think. Can you see my mind like defragging?
I can hear it, mate.
Yeah, I'm like going. I think my whole life's flashing in front of my eyes. I don't even know if I'm like. See, when I walk on stage now,
that's what I was going to say. You walk on stage in front of thousands of people. Like that's not something anyone can do. Do you know what I mean? There's a confidence to that.
I know. But you should see the state of me before. You should see what it takes to get to that point. It's like a really long build up. All day. I have no idea where it comes from, mate. I have no idea. Because I'm terrified walking on stage. And I'm terrified. I'm not now, but I was terrified to like approach my wife and like say, like, I like you, or like, can I get your number? Or I just couldn't. I don't know. I don't know if you know what? Maybe I've just spent so many years hiding behind metaphors and artwork. I went to art school as well, and between the two phases we're talking about, me now and me as a kid, I went to art school as well, and I've always just kind of buried my head into like, not my head, I've buried probably my real self behind made up versions of me. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, absolutely.
Songs and paintings and lyrics, stuff that I like to take the attention off of me, probably.
Yeah.
But I do think you can learn to be more confident. I do, but the only way I think you do it is by every single day constantly being out of your comfort zone to the point where you just don't have a comfort zone anymore. I think you need to. That's my experience anyway.
Confidence aside, then choosing. Initially, I guess, looking at art, you know, to make money in the world.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
World of art isn't easy. To make a career in music is not easy. You know, to have achieved the level of success that you've achieved in music is really fucking not easy. So confidence aside, how driven are you?
I feel rude not saying like thank you for saying everything you just said there, firstly, before I like keep talking about myself. I'm driven to the point of like fucking driving people away from me, probably. It's too much, mate. It's too much, but I've learned how to park it and let it build and let it build and let it build and let it build. Sometimes for 3 months at a time, it seems like I'm not doing something, but I'm like deep in thought about how to take something to the next level, or how do I beat my best, you know, live show or gig, or how do I get better at interviews, or how do I get, do you know what I mean? How do I like let my guard down, and how do I like, I'll think about something like that for like 3-4 months at a time, so that I can make an album in 5 weeks at home with minimal gear. If you know what I mean, like the drive is it's unhealthy at times, but that's partly why I love being in a band, because I'm the guy who's like laser focused, so driven, but then having guys to like fall back on who are more laid back, or someone who's more got like their life and or their moral compass is stronger than mine. So like having people like that around me to bounce off of.
Ultimately, every band needs one of you in it, though.
Yeah, I think so. But I've seen a lot of bands. You can be too driven. I'm saying I'm so driven, but I'm really focused with it. If you know what I mean, I'm really. I would say that I'm like a pretty solid like people person. I like can read people well, so I know when to like shut up about pestering people for a support slot or something, or how to make it not all about me, but somehow in the end it was all about me. I'm like a twisted manipulator, I think. My drive, but I think it's sparked from like my upbringing was like really, really good and amazing and dead happy, but as you get older you realise like I don't know, that was probably quite tough and I was just a wee guy, so I didn't know. And I think the things I've seen around me growing up have just been like, I never want to be back in that situation. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's probably driven, like, I don't think I was just born with drive. I think it was some of the stuff I've seen along the way, or some of the situations my family have been in, have probably made me like, it wasn't even like I lit a fire under me. The fire was lit by others and I'm like trying to climb up away from it, type of thing. And then I don't know, now that is just inbuilt within me. So anything that I try and take on, I'm like, our bass player Ross sometimes says to me like, dude, it's too, your weight, it's, relax. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but if you're in a band where everyone just relaxes, then, you know, in a much smaller scale, I was you in my band. And, you know, when I look back at it now, 20 years later, we wouldn't have got the deal. We wouldn't have done this. We wouldn't have done that had it not been, and I don't mean this taking anything away from the rest of the band, me being that guy that's going, no, we need to do this. We've got to do that. That will help us do that. And yeah. I think every band needs that. I really do. And I think I would sometimes look at the other guys in the band and just think, oh man, I wish I was a bit more like you. I wish I could just kind of put my feet up in the van and just think, oh, let's just enjoy the ride. But I was always thinking of the next thing, of how we could then take it to there and what we could do with that. And I think that can become all encompassing. And it can sometimes, I think, when you take a minute and look at it, just go, oh man, like, but I think if you've got that inherent drive and that desire to do the best possible version of what you're doing, then I think that's who you are and that's what you should do.
Yeah, mate, it's just good old Glaswegian working class roots.
Yeah.
Just my grandparents, my mum and dad, I've just seen them hustle, do you know what I mean? And just work so hard that then given an opportunity to be on the stage with like my heroes that had posters up on the wall and stuff like that, I'm like, right, I'm grabbing this with two hands.
Damn right.
And running as fast as I can with it.
Damn right.
Let's go back to them roots you just mentioned. Track six, favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
It says home county.
You can go country. 350 of my 360 guests have all said country. Don't worry. I need to rearrange how I write that in the email.
My home county. Well, I'm a rare breed where I actually am from Glasgow, like from the city of Glasgow, like born in the city, lived in the city, still live in the city just about. I still got a G at the front of my postcode.
I'm happy for you to go with country because there's some songs on your list that I'd like to talk about.
Well, I just kind of was rhyming these off without really thinking about it too much, like Jerry Rafferty, Baker Street. I put Travis, Why Does It Always Rain On Me? But I mean, there's like five or six Travis songs that could be on this list. To be cheeky, I put AC/DC, Back in Black.
You can have that. You can have that.
It's like Scotland's like, no, we've got a world famous rock band. Annie Lennox, Walking on Broken Glass. Annie Lennox, Why? Deacon Blue, Dignity.
Right, so many I want to pull apart here, right? So Annie Lennox, first of all, have you ever heard the original of No More I Love Yous?
Not her version of it, you mean?
That's a fucking cover, man.
Is it?
Yeah, and I didn't know this until maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, and it's from this kind of mid-80s kind of sort of synth band,
really?
That ended up touring with the Eurythmics and were kind of working with Dave Stewart as well.
What are they called? Well, I'll look it up after this. I'll find
what they're called. But it's fucking amazing. It's this huge, epic kind of synth record that sounds like sort of like a big Aha sort of slowy. It's huge. And yeah, I mean, it's an incredible record, you know, and the Annie Lennox version's amazing. But yeah, go check out the original. It was like, when I say Annie Lennox, I see your email and I was like, man, like, I wonder if you heard the original of that, because it's literally been my earworm for the last few weeks. And Deacon Blue, well, I got sent something the other day, and I've got this thing with, I work with a musician called Scroobius Pip. He's the guy that got me into doing this.
Right.
And we have this thing where we sort of message each other. If we see a little, if I'm feeling a little bit hungover or a bit jaded, I quite like to have a little YouTube watch of songs that are going to kind of get me a bit emotional. And I like to kind of sort of work through it like that, I think. I think I've replaced listening to kind of somber music now. I just go on there, because when I hear Crads, it gives me just a feeling that I've never, it blows my mind. When you hear Crads singing lyrics, it fucking destroys me. And so we send each other like, oh man, have you heard this? And he sent me, I sent him Proclaimers, Sunshine and Leaf at Tea in the Park. That'll fucking do it, mate. But he then topped me by sending back Dignity at Tea in the Park a few years ago by Deacon Blue. Oh man. Ricky don't even sing. He just lets them sing it. Yeah. Oh, fucking hell, man.
I don't know. There's something about that song, isn't there? It's just like, I've got so many memories attached to that song from my whole life, basically. And it's always the point in a night where everyone's just steaming enough, where they're still happy. It can be the song that sort of triggers the point, oh, no, she's crying, what's that? Do you know what I mean? So, or he's, why is he shouting at him? What's going on? Blah, blah, blah. Because it's usually a moment in a night in Scotland where, like, young through to old, or like, no matter, I mean, like, you could have had on like top 10 chart music or something like that, and then this song comes on and it just pulls everyone together. Maybe I'm thinking it's just a cultural thing in Scotland. Maybe it happens with this song.
Well, I can give you an example, right? So I'm a club promoter. That's kind of what I do as well. And I had a club night in London, and maybe 6 years ago, Edith Bowman came to DJ for me. And Edith was playing like kind of lots of big sort of indie bangers and stuff like that. And there's like sort of 600-700 people jumping around to all the kind of big hits. And then she drops Dignity. And I was thinking, that's a fucking brave move.
Like, you're in the middle of Shoreditch, yeah. Like, I know this song. I'm 48.
Complete sense, obviously. That's like a normal move up here.
Within a minute, the place was on fire to it. And it's like, it works down south as well. Like, nice.
It's such a huge song. I mean, I'm apart from Back in Black on that list, which was obviously slightly tongue-in-cheek, all the songs on this list, when I look from bottom to top, not just this question, they've got that sort of like happy, sad thing going on. Melancholy, but like joyful melancholy. Even like Travis, Why Does It Always Rain On Me, is just so, it's like a fellow Glaswegian of them. It's like, that just sums up, like any other, see if that was like a soul song or something like that, or a metal song with that title. There's something about that title being from a Scottish band is just so relatable to me. When you listen to it, it's I don't know.
As a Glaswegian, is it inspiring seeing, you know, bands like Travis, you know, go on to do what they've done, as a young lad, sort of seeing these bands become, you know, global superstars? You know, would you draw from that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, massively. I mean, there's so many Scottish artists. That's why, because I was thinking like, oh, I'll just say like Proclaimers 500 Miles, because I'm not Scottish unless that's my answer.
Sure.
And I was like, man, for such a small country with such a limited route to access to even recording studios, never mind the music industry, like, we get so many like massively impactful artists and songs. Maybe that's why I take like songwriting really seriously, and like the craft of it is dead important to me, because I've got like, I very easily could have just like just churn out another one of those types of songs and we'll do well and blah blah blah. But I'm like, nah, I need to evolve and I need to like show growth in songwriting. I don't know. I feel like Scottish songwriters are taken like seriously. I don't know. Maybe they're not.
Definitely. I mean, I set out just to do this podcast. Initially, I was going to do it on certain locations, each series on a certain location, to understand why there seems to be this desire that if you want to make it in music, you know, you've got to move to London. And this was bred purely out of the fact that I live just outside of London in Essex. And I would chat to the aforementioned Scroobius Pip. At the time was having a very successful time in music.
Mm-hmm.
And all he would get asked is like, oh, like, do you live in London? Like, and he's like, no, I live in Essex. Well, are you going to move to London? He's like, nah, like, I like where I live. And I asked that. I had Fran and Dougie from Travis on, and I'm trying to think of what other incredible Scottish bands I spoke to. Roddy from Idlewild, who are an incredible band. And just about their love of where they come from, and that lack of, we're doing it on our terms where we're at. And, you know, you come to us, like, you know, there's a rich heritage of music from Glasgow. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, I find it, and I think that's what creates scenes, and that's what creates kind of movements in music, is that, you know, so many times, you know, Manchester gets mentioned on this podcast, you know, that kind of 89, 91, Roses, Mondays in Spirals, that kind of movement. That's you know, that's a city's done that, and I think Glasgow's got a wealth of incredible talent, and I think if that's there in the very fabric of it, to go for sort of full circle, you know, that must be something that you can draw from and go, well, look, you know, we might not have the best studios and, you know, everything at our disposal like maybe they have in London, but seeing everything that's come before me means this is totally fucking doable, right?
Well, yeah, massively. I think there's just something about the fabric of this place that when you leave it behind, like, you really miss it to the point of distraction, because there's nowhere else really like home, obviously, for everyone out there. But I don't know what it is about Glasgow. It's probably, I mean, like, it rains all the time. It is quite a miserable place, but with, like, the happiest people you meet. And that is obviously a thread through all these songs that I've picked here. It's quite a dangerous place, but then it's also probably the one of the first places that someone would step out to, like, protect you or something. Do you know what I mean? Sure. It's quite a kind of... I mean, it's quite an extreme flip-flop between the two. But that I don't know whether that breeds creativity or I'm not sure what it is.
I'm sure it would definitely breed confidence and certainly drive.
Well, I think now that I'm thinking a bit clearer, I think what made me that sort of confident in front of people was, like, working in bars in Glasgow. When I was at art school, I worked in a couple of different bars, one called Block and one called Nice and Sleazy's. Nice and Sleazy is quite a kind of, like, cultural hotspot here. It's, like, quite a famous music venue as well. And it was a sink or swim situation because of the customers that were coming in. And, like, Block had, like, a punk venue you just set up on the floor, but it was, like, quite revered amongst, like, that sort of community. Mm-hmm. Nice and Sleazy was, like, the extreme snobby indie art school music scene. And if you didn't just immediately, like, take to, do you know what I mean? How you would talk to people, and the way you dress, or how you conduct yourself, or, like, in Glasgow, if somebody was giving you a hard time, if you can't just, like, own it and deal with it, we couldn't really work in those places. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I think that was what maybe helped me with hecklers and shit like that live, or the crowd not being on my side, or whatever it is, to have that confidence to kind of win them over. I got schooled, like, working in the bars here.
Okay, for your final track, you get to play Tastemaker, Sam, and I'm going to ask you, please, to tell me a song that you think many people may not know that you would like them to hear, please.
Yeah, well, this is I think I must have just been on one with this playlist that I've put together. I must have been feeling sad or something, like, where I got to the end of all these songs and this was one that sort of jumped out at me. It's a band from the States called Make Do and Mend. The song's called St. Anne. And, I mean, I don't know, there's something about it. Every time I hear it, I need to, like, right, everyone shut up. I need to turn this up. I need to, like, really listen to this. It kind of comes round. Like, I'll maybe only listen to it, like, once or twice a year. Or maybe even once every couple of years. But when I hear it, it's just, like, it does a certain thing to me. And I think when other people will hear it for the first time, it'll have the same effect. It's just so desperately sad, but, like, it's like a hard-hitting rock song, but it's in the sort of ballad territory, I would say. But the guy's vocal, I think they're from Boston. I can't remember. I'm not even sure they're East Coast now that I'm saying that. But the Twin Atlantic, we played in 2012, we did the Warped Tour in the States, and we don't really fit into that scene. Do you know what I mean? We've got one foot in that world because we've got melodic kind of power pop stuff happening, big rock moments, but we don't really fit into that scene. And all the other bands on the tour, to me, bar maybe four or five, I was like, this is fucking awful. I hate this. And I hate how they're treating their fans, and I hate how it's all about, like, merch and, like, how many piercings and tattoos and shit you've got. And I've got tattoos and that, I'm not slagging it, but it was more like the image of the whole thing. And this band, because your time slot changes every day on Warped Tour, you could be playing at 11 in the morning and then 4 in the afternoon and blah, 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 whatever you are. And I just, like, heard this song live and I was like, what the that is a piece of me. That is, like, completely different to everything else on this tour. And then I ended up, like, I just revisit it to get that feeling again. The guy's got, like, a really rough, gravelly voice singing this really, like, sweet, emotional song. I don't know. It's just a really good example of sad but happy, hopeful nostalgia.
Well, Sam, we put together a Spotify playlist to accompany the podcast, so people can go and listen to that track and all the other tracks that we've spoken about today.
What crazy playlist this is going to be?
Yeah, if somebody's just getting stuck into the rock stuff and then all of a sudden Rewind's going to drop as well with some smashed glass and explosions, yeah. It's brilliant. But just to sort of start to wrap things up, as 2021 is starting to kind of come to a close, and a more connected and happier close it will be than 2020. What are you looking forward to from the rest of this year, personally, and what's going to be happening professionally?
Well, personally, I've just the room that I'm in, I've just finished. I converted my garage into a studio, so I'm going to be just living in here basically till Christmas.
Yeah.
Working away. So I've started out personally, I was going to be professional. There's a crossover, isn't there?
There always is.
See, because of the pandemic, it's the longest I've ever spent in Glasgow as in my adult life, basically since I was like 18, because we started touring when I was like 19, and there were some years we did like over 200 gigs a year and stuff like that. I was just never here. So I've kind of like fallen back in love with all the things, like going to the football, like stuff I just didn't really get a chance to do. Properly having, like, knowing what the rest of my family are doing, yeah, with their week, so I can like be more a part of all that. And then professionally, I mean, yeah, being in here. We've got an album coming out in January. Here's the big plug. Will I go into professional plugging mode?
Do it.
Our new album, Transparency, is coming out on the 7th of January. You can pre-order it now.
You're getting a voiceover work, mate.
Yes, mate. So I'll be talking about that loads in the next few months and doing videos and, yeah.
Excellent. Sam, it's been an absolute joy talking records with you, man. It's been delightful. Like,
thank you. Thank you for the best question I've ever been asked that caused me to nearly unravel. In front of your very eyes and ears.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks, man.
Nice one, mate.
There you go. Oh, what a delight Sam was. We had a nice little natter afterwards as well, telling me about what he was going to do for the rest of the day. Go get some fish and chips by the seaside. What a glorious way to spend your day. Yeah, absolute top gent. Really enjoyed that. I hope you've got as much pleasure listening as I did having that natter. Why not go check out some other chats now? Better still, subscribe to the podcast, then they just pop up on your listening device. You don't have to do anything. You'll just get a little thing that goes, bing, Stuart's been talking to blah, blah, blah this week. And you can either press play or you can not. Simple. But yeah, go explore the back catalogue and get stuck in to some other ace chats. I'm back next time. In the meantime, give us a like, love, share, retweet, all the usual stuff that I ask you to do. And also, if you want to support the podcast, there's a Patreon, which will cost you 79p a month, and you get bags of other content there and access to a back catalogue of a couple of hundred episodes and radio shows and video episodes and stuff there. You can find out about it all at your one-stop podcast shop, which is www.offthebeatandtrackpodcast.com. I'm back next time, you bloody lovely lot. Have a smashing week. Be excellent to each other. Love ya. Bye-bye.
It's Off the Beat and Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whippin.